From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Filmmaker Scott Porter didn't know that nearly 400,000 German prisoners of war were confined to camps here in the U.S. during World War II. But a few years ago, he was interviewing his grandmother, and unprompted, she told him that some of these German POWs had come to work on the family's farm in northern Utah. And it turns out 8,000 of these prisoners lived in camps throughout the state, which is interesting, yes, but here's the part that made him want to make a film. His grandmother, who was a young girl at the time, said she and others came to know these men and to like them, to see them as something more than enemies in a conflict. Porter's new film is focused on that part of the story. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film. Porter will join us to talk about the story of German prisoners of war in Utah. After the news.
Hello, podcast listener. This is Elaine Clark. I'm one of the producers for Radio West. You'll notice today's show's a little bit shorter than usual. It's because it's KUER's fall fund drive, so you're missing out on several minutes of appeal to support the station, Radio West, and the podcast you're listening to. But you're savvy. You know how it works. KUER relies on your support to make this all possible. If you're already a sustainer, thank you. If not, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Just go to our website, radiowest.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It might be a surprise to some of you that thousands of German prisoners of World War II were sent across the ocean here to the United States. There were hundreds of thousands of these POWs, nearly 400,000 situated in 500 or so camps in nearly every state in the country. In Scott Porter's new documentary film, we see some of the footage of the prisoners coming off ships and being put on trains. Now, mind you, these weren't cattle cars. They were put in Pullman cars with seats and berths and service. And in fact, it's hard not to compare the treatment of those prisoners to the way the Nazis packed Jews into freight cars on their way to concentration camps. German POWs in the United States had heated barracks in three squares. They had rec rooms and gardens and bands and choirs. And given what was going on in Europe, Americans could be forgiven for fearing or at least resenting the prisoners who were being settled near their communities. But over time, as they got to know them, many came to see these prisoners differently. And that idea is at the heart of Porter's film. He tells the story of some of the 8,000 or so of these German POWs who ended up here in Utah. Today in the program, we are continuing our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Next week, we're going to be screening Porter's film. Today in the program, we're talking about it. It's called Splinters of a Nation. Scott Porter's debut documentary film is Splinters of a Nation, which he wrote and directed and produced. And he's joining us here in the studio. And Scott Porter, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So let's begin with the story of you finding this story. So your grandmother, you're interviewing her a couple of years ago. Now, she hasn't told anyone this story. Certainly, she hadn't told you this story, right? And so you're interviewing, you're doing one of those things where you're like, hey, Grandma, let's get you, sit you down and videotape your story.
Right.
And just out of nowhere, she tells this story?
Yeah, and maybe she told it before. But,
yeah,
you know,
you can't remember.
To her, it's normal. You know, this story, it's just World War II. It's normal.
Yeah.
But to me, it was unbelievable. So I was filming for an hour, and then she has this great little 2-minute story, just 2 minutes long.
Right.
Oh,
but she's
no
done
big
it before.
Deal. Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
No big deal. German prisoners of war back in the summer of 1945. Well, they came to my family's farm in Lewiston, Utah for most of the summer, and I went, what? Grandma, wait a minute. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I remember stopping and just saying, this isn't in the textbooks. You know, this isn't in high school Utah history classes. This isn't even in college history classes that I've ever heard. And so I was blown away by it. But what, as you mentioned, as was mentioned previously, to me, what I was blown away by wasn't the fact that they were here.
Yeah.
That was certainly interesting. But was the fact that she, a civilian, interacted with them. And the interaction was very interesting in that she hated these guys at first. Well, naturally, because they were the ones trying to kill her uncles who were fighting overseas. But by the end of one summer, she grew to realize that they were, well, just like her, you know. And in talking to her dad, she realized that they were just humans in a lot of ways, conscripted to fight just like our boys were. And so for me, that was really interesting. And as I researched that further, I was astonished to learn that that wasn't even a unique story, that this same scene that played out in a rural farm in Utah played out across America in farms, you know, in 46 states during World War II.
I want to talk more about that idea. There is, of course, contained in the film a really tragic shooting that plays out in Salina.
Right.
And we'll talk a little bit about this as a little bit later on the program. But as the film says, it was kind of the biggest blemish anyway in what the film calls this really successful program.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what you wanted the film to be. It could have been just about the shooting.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So tell us a little bit about how you sort of measured all these different elements together.
No, that's one of the greatest challenges of making a film is giving it edges and determining, you know, the story that you want to tell. And certainly, as you've alluded to, the story in Salina, Utah is a fascinating story. It could be an entire film just on the subject. In fact, many people have tried, have started one and have quit because it's difficult to tell that story as well. But also, Salina is kind of the micro story of this. Certainly not a usual interaction between Americans and Germans, and we'll talk about that. But larger across America, there's an even bigger story. And so there's kind of this macro focus and there's this micro focus. But for me, it really came down to I wanted to tell the human side of German prisoners of war in America, specifically with the lens of Utah, and Salina plays into that.
Yeah.
And we can talk a little bit about the Salina massacre if you want.
We will. We'll come back
sure.
to that.
Okay.
It's a terrible story.
Yeah.
I think what's most terrible about it is it comes after the surrender of Germany.
Yeah, after the war's over.
The war is over.
Yep.
So it makes it all the more tragic, and we'll get to that.
Okay.
Splinters of a Nation. Where does that title come from? This comes from Ogden, someone in Ogden.
It does. And so for me, my experience of finding this title first came from a book called Splinters of a Nation, written by Alan Kent Powell back in 1989, University of Utah Press. That's where I first experienced this. And then, of course, in there I learned that of a great quote that came from an unknown prisoner from a camp newspaper up in Ogden right after the war, after the Salina massacre. And basically, it was a prisoner who was referring to the state of Germany after the war, which to him, he felt like a splinter of this nation.
Yeah.
And that's what he described in this quote, feeling like he had been blown apart. And Germans were all over the world, but he happened to be in Utah. And now these splinters were going to go back and basically rebuild Germany.
It's another important part of the film is the idea of what they're having to go back to.
Absolutely. Something I never understood. In fact, I would imagine most Americans, most Utahns have no idea what it's like to go back to a defeated country because we don't live in one. But Germans, if you can put yourself in their place, which I did eventually through this film, but we don't do in history classes here in Utah or in America.
Why?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's just it's difficult to tell. I don't think people care, honestly, frankly. I think people do care, but I think the general public, we don't feel like we can learn anything from that. But for me, I learned a great deal putting myself in their place, and especially when I realized that most of the prisoners who came to America weren't even Nazis, that these were conscripted men, that these were, you know, in a lot of ways against Hitler. Some of them maybe felt some sympathy for Hitler, but a lot of them had no desire to support Hitler.
What's interesting is to see the kind of different waves of soldiers. Like in those early days, they came from like North Africa, for example.
Right.
And I'm guessing they were more gung-ho in those
days.
And then the last kind of stragglers at the last part of this experience, you mentioned in the film, they range from 13 years old to 60
That's
years
right.
old.
Isn't that amazing?
So conscripted. I mean,
right.
The country obviously really desperate. Yeah.
And then they'd send 13 to 60-year-olds. And it was, for me, I interviewed a handful of living prisoners, of course, in all of them held in Ogden together, which was really interesting. We also interviewed the wife of one who was held in Tooele.
Yeah.
And
who escaped.
And he was different. So he was Africa Corps, and these others that we interviewed were all young. In fact, all of them were young, but 18, 17 years old when they were captured. I mean, these are young men.
They kind of had to be because you were talking in order for you to have been able to talk to him over the past couple of years. Because
somebody
had mentioned to you when you said, I really want to talk to some of these prisoners. Somebody said, dude, you're 10 years late.
Oh, yeah. In fact, when I first started to research, I tried literally to talk to every single scholar who's ever written on the subject, which there's not that many, but especially those who had interviewed prisoners. And every single one of them said, you're 10 years too late, exactly what you just said. But for me, I come from a younger generation than some of these scholars, and so I turned to the internet.
Yeah, of course.
And searched in German with German-only results with unique qualifier words like Tooele and German prisoner of war camp, and we found some people, which is amazing, but barely in the nick of time. In fact, some of them have already passed since we came back from Germany in 2013.
You managed to bring three of these gentlemen together to talk.
Yeah, in the middle of Germany, Meschede, Germany. And one of these fellows lived in the east side of Germany after the war. All of these three were friends in Ogden together, and so they had kind of a reunion interview together in Meschede. And we literally put them around a table and let them tell stories. And I don't speak any German, so you can imagine, as the producer director, I felt like I was ruining the film because these guys are just talking, and most of it's laughing and pointing sometimes at me, you know, while the camera's rolling, and I have no idea what they're saying. But we found some real gems in that when I got back and had it translated, that they really just told it like it was. And it's hard sometimes as an American when you're interviewing Germans to get their true feelings, you know, because they maybe cloud them a bit with, you know, respect for you as, you know, somebody from the other side. Yeah. But when they're talking to each other, boy, they just tell it as it is.
Let's talk a little bit, set this up for us a bit. Give us I hadn't realized the scale of this issue. I mean, we were talking, there were at various times in the war, I mean, there ends up being millions of German prisoners of war.
Yeah.
And they have to figure out, what are we going to do with this many? Talk about the scale of this. I mean, nearly 400,000 end up here in the United States.
Right. Yeah. So the scale over in Europe and in the areas where they were fighting was enormous. And this is, again, something we don't teach in history classes. Nobody thinks about. But imagine if you defeat the Germans. In the end, a scholar in Germany told me, obviously, everybody was a German prisoner of war, and I hadn't even considered that, but everybody was walking around that country, outside, around the world. These were all German prisoners of war. There was millions of them. And the challenge was for the Allies is they captured these guys, sometimes by the hundreds of thousands, literally in North Africa. They would put a fence around them, and then they would worry because if they escaped, that's not even the biggest worry. The biggest worry, how do you feed these guys?
Exactly.
The manpower, the American and ally manpower, how do you put these guys in a fence? And so they realized all these ships were coming from overseas full of equipment. They dropped them off and they were empty.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, what if we put, you know, prisoners on those ships and sent them back? They filled up England first until they were bulging and the British couldn't take them. And the Americans finally said, well, we'll put them on these ships and we'll take them back. And I don't know what we'll do with them, but we'll care for them.
Well, the Americans came up with a plan.
Sure.
As you said, 500 some odd locations, nearly every state in the country, 46 mm-hmm. states. It was a massive undertaking. We'll get to the kinds of camps that
sure.
they were, because that's pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
But give us a sense of how Americans were reacting in those early days.
Sure.
I'm trying to compare that reaction to one that might happen today. I mean, you know, you're hearing people who are freaking out because terrorist suspects are tried in New York, and yet you're taking what Americans must have thought were the most dangerous people in the world, and they're going to be put in these rural enclaves near family farms and factories and all of this stuff.
Absolutely. You know, and to me, it's interesting. There's two sides of the story. One is when you're looking at history, one is what's recorded, right, in the newspapers, which generally you're going to find what's surprising and shocking, right? And so you nailed it. Basically, the Americans were very upset, a lot of them. We can't take these men, you know, all of that you can imagine. But then there's people, I think, like my grandfather, my great-grandfather, I should say, who accepted these prisoners to his farm in Lewiston and just had a totally different view.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's hard to tell really the consensus at that time, but we believe it was very against receiving all of these men. I mean, for good reasons.
For good reasons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. I want to play a clip from the film. This is Rüdiger Overmans, a military historian who's in the film. And I think this is interesting because he talks about something that hadn't occurred to me. You had all these young men, most of them young, at least in those early days,
sure.
who get off these Liberty ships and are put on these trains to go to these different kinds of places. And as Rüdiger Overmans explains, this would have been a very new experience to some of these young men.
The agreement protecting this for many, you have imagined that at that times a German average soldier did not have the chance to leave to be on vacations in any foreign country. Therefore, it was for them it was very impressive to have such a long journey over the sea and see the Statue of Liberty and enter a totally different country.
It's interesting to think about that. And you show sort of the landscape passing by, some of the historical footage, the way you put it together, to give a sense of the contrast. Their country was being obliterated. Mm-hmm. The United States, they were sort of wandering past these bucolic, beautiful places untouched. It must have been an amazing contrast.
Yeah, you know, and you, sometimes we even forget about the propaganda that was being spread. The Germans, some of them, literally believed that New York had been bombed and destroyed. And here they are pulling into New York Harbor. There's the Statue of Liberty. There's this beautiful, bustling city. Where's the destruction that they had been taught about? Then they get on these trains and they go across the country. And there is these beautiful fields, people out working. It's plentiful. Everything seems to be untouched by the war. And they were shocked, as you can imagine.
I mentioned in the introduction something that struck me when you see some of those German prisoners in some of the historical footage sitting in these really nice Pullman cars, comparing it, as I said. It's hard not to make that comparison to the Jews who were crammed into these cattle cars.
Sure, sure.
Say something about that, because that really does come up from time to time when you make a contrast from the experience. You see these guys in gardens and in rec rooms recreating and heated barracks and nice bunks, the comparison to what's going on in Germany and throughout Eastern Europe.
Even in Utah, I mean, we think of Topaz.
Yeah.
We think of the Japanese Americans who were interned and the difference of internment. But one thing we have to keep in mind, it's true, these Germans really had it well. In fact, a lot of them called it paradise. I mean, you can imagine, you're in Germany, you're being bombed, or you're not in Germany, you're in North Africa, you're overseas somewhere, your life is in danger, your living conditions are horrible. You don't have enough food to eat. Your clothing is deteriorating quickly. And then you're shipped to America and you're put on a Pullman car, which is the nice, you know, a nice train ride. You're put in a camp with, you know, a nice barrack. You have a nice bed to sleep on. And it almost seems unfair. And so you can imagine the media and the local civilians started to get really upset. Why are they eating better than we are? We're rationed.
Yeah.
And these guys are eating the rations. It's mind-blowing. But then you have to look at the side, the military history side or the military infrastructure side. The rules were that this is how it was supposed to be done. This is what was done across the world in theory, if you're abiding by the rules. And so it wasn't extravagant according to what they were supposed to do, international law.
Well, the Americans were intent, as you mentioned in the film, on showing the rest of the Germans, of course, in particular, that, hey, we're abiding by the Geneva Convention.
Right.
And as one of the historians in the film says, you know, we had 370,000 of theirs. They had some 90,000 prisoners of ours. We wanted them treated well. Let me play just a little clip from a kind of a U.S. I'm not sure it's a propaganda film, but it's interesting to sort of see the way the Americans, the message they were trying to send to the rest of the world with the way they were treating these German POWs.
War prisoners received the same rations as American soldiers, or an equivalent in their own type of food if they preferred. These Signal Corps pictures show a fully equipped recreation room provided for the captives, who even have their own band. America scrupulously observes the principles of humanity in her treatment of war prisoners.
So that was the message. Now, do we know, Scott, whether or not, in fact, our prisoners, that message was getting across, that our prisoners were also treated well, you know?
The reciprocation of it, you mean?
Yeah, it wasn't part of the film, but I'm wondering if you know.
No, sure. It's a tricky subject.
Yeah.
And so we're not certain exactly, but we do know that there was some message received, that even postcards would go home. And the Americans were very careful not to censor those postcards. They wanted the Germans to know that these men were being treated well. And so even if the government maybe, you know, didn't believe it or whatever, the civilians did, because they received these letters, and they would in turn treat the American German or the American prisoners who were in German camps similar ways. And especially towards the end of the war, that certainly helped, because the Americans weren't the bad guys. Where you look at Russia, who had treated their German prisoners horribly, and some of the others, countries that had just really, really treated Germans poorly. And so there was some winning over of the German country as a result. But I think that they were hoping for even more.
Yeah. Rec rooms, as was said, bands, they had theaters and classes and tennis and boxing and ping pong, a garden. And this is where you make the reference to that there was, what did they call it, the Fritz Ritz?
Yeah.
There was resentment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They were getting rationed and they were like, these guys have it way better than we do.
Yeah. They wanted to go inside. And,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. No, they had it was paradise, as mentioned. And you're referring to some of the biggest camps. So,
sure.
So there was a big camp in Ogden, for example, that had 4,000 prisoners all crowded together at the old Ogden Depot, which is still there today. On the north end of that is where these prisoners were held by the thousands. And Italians, too, we should mention. We had lots of Italians in Utah as well. But these Germans, they had it well, because they were there together, thousands of them. They created recreation fields. You know, they would get together. They'd show movies. They'd read books. They'd have a canteen where they could buy beer. They could basically just live it up. And the Americans liked that to some extent, because as long as they were busy doing something, there was less problems. When you try to keep them from having any fun, that's when it's challenging to hold the enemy. And that's why they also wanted them to work.
Yeah.
You know,
this is a point made by one of the people in your film, Arthur Kramer. He's a professor at Texas A&M, I guess.
Arnold Kramer.
Arnold Kramer. Mm-hmm. And he makes this point in this scene from the film. There was a strategy. Let's keep them busy. Here's another moment from the film Splinters of a Nation.
The program was keep them tired, because if you keep the prisoners of war tired, however you keep them tired, they'll be less likely to escape. So we encourage them to get involved in sports. You could drive by a camp, for instance, and stop your car at the barbed wire fence, and you could make bets with the guards which team was going to win, which one would lose, and so on.
So 12 camps here in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Tremont and Ogden, you said, was a big one. There's mm-hmm. one in Logan. There's one in Brigham City, Clearfield, Hillfield. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Fort Douglas, of course.
Mm-hmm.
One in Tooele, one in Orem, one in Dugway, one in Deseret, Salina. That's where the tragedy took mm-hmm. place. We'll talk a little bit about that. Are there any old foundations, or is there anything left of any of these camps anywhere in the state? Do you know?
That's one of the sad realities of my research, is that this story has basically vanished. There is very little left. The Ogden Depot is still there, but on the land now, there's still government owned. There's nothing. You wouldn't know that it was ever a German prisoner of war camp.
Hmm.
Down in Salina is about the only place that I know of that they're actively trying to preserve the story. And the site where this tragic massacre took place, currently they're trying to open a museum. And it was a CCC camp, and then it was a German prisoner of war camp. But the artifacts that were there originally are all gone. And so a lot of what we had to do is recreate
yeah.
some of these camps, and which aren't that hard. It's a lot of barbed wire and wood, you know. I mean, these things aren't meant to stick around forever. And a lot of them came from CCC camps originally, so the infrastructure was already there, and they just added to them and kind of made them their own. But yeah, I mean, these camps were, you know, all over the place. But Ogden was the real base camp.
Right.
That's the biggest camp we had in Utah. All the other ones kind of reported to that. In fact, some of them in Idaho and Arizona and some of the other areas reported to Ogden.
I wonder, I was thinking that, I wonder if one of the reasons people aren't remembering this story or don't talk about it that much is, and this comes up later in the film, which we'll get to, once the images from the atrocities at these concentration camps start to emerge, that became so painful, there became so much outrage, so much of a visceral reaction from Americans of what had been happening in those places, And I know this may even, of course, a lot of Germans feel this way too. This maybe this inclination to just want to forget that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think most prisoners do. In fact, you can imagine, put yourself in my shoes for a moment. I'm sitting in Meschede, Germany with these Germans. And of course, I don't speak German, but we're asking. I know the questions we're asking. Now we're talking about the Holocaust. That's got to be an uncomfortable conversation for an American to come into your home and ask you about. But their reactions to me are very, very interesting. And now we're starting to really learn, how much did the Germans really know about the Holocaust? It's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
We believe that they knew some things. In fact, that's exactly what one of the prisoners told me. Some things were known. We knew something was happening with the Jews. We didn't know what was happening. And one of them told me he guarded one of these camps with the Jews. But if, you know, in his words, he doesn't know what happened to them. They disappeared one day and that was that. So it's a mixed bag on what they really knew. All that I can tell you from my research, and certainly the scholars would also suggest this, that the prisoners felt horrible. The majority felt it rocked them to the core if they could get themselves to believe it. And so they thought this was Hollywood. A lot of people did. A lot of these prisoners thought this is Hollywood at its finest. But it was painful for many of them to even know that this is the government that they were fighting for. Look what they've done.
Scott Porter is with us. His documentary film, which he wrote, directed, and produced, is called Splinters of a Nation. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday evening at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Scott's going to be with us, along with historian Alan Kent Powell, who wrote a book about it that Scott was referring to earlier. He appears in the film as well. He'll be there for a Q&A. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our documentary film series with the story of German prisoners of World War II in Utah. Some 8,000 German POWs were confined here in 12 different camps around the state during World War II. And many of these prisoners here and elsewhere worked alongside American civilians on farms and in factories. And in some cases, some unlikely friendships developed between people who were supposed to be enemies. The film was called Splinters of a Nation. We're going to be screening the film next week, next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Today in the program, the filmmaker Scott Porter is joining us to talk about his story, which he wrote and directed and produced. So there were these rules, at least on paper, that you were supposed to be about civilians and POWs. They were supposed to be separate. But one of the things you mentioned in the film is these rules were broken a lot.
It was never going to work kind of from the beginning unless they stayed for a couple of days and left. I mean, civilians were curious. They would drive down and try to look through the fence. Of course, some civilians worked, for example, in the Ogden area, in the Ogden Depot. This is the largest employer in Ogden and Weber County and in the state. Thousands and thousands of these civilians are working on war-related things. And right next door is a German and an Italian prisoner of war camp. And then, of course, the labor crisis happens, which is going to happen in a war like this. We've
all
lost.
Men at the time were overseas.
Tens of 60,000 plus were gone. And there were some real problems. And so we had lots of women who stepped up, were working really hard in these factories. And the German prisoners were the next best option to the men who had left. So they fixed them up. They went to work there at the depot, for example. They worked right next to women at times. And the rules were strict. Now they've already broken some rules, which is civilians and German prisoners should never interact. Now they're working in some cases side by side. And occasionally they talk.
And when you talk, barriers break down, and this is what happens. Let me play another moment from the film. This is Alan Kent Powell, the historian, wrote a book about this. We'll also hear from Allie Lee Lawler. You want to say something a little bit about her and some of the other people that you talked to? These were they're older now, obviously, but talking about their experiences of encountering these German POWs.
Yeah, one of our goals as we were filming, we had just returned from Germany, interviewed a bunch of German prisoners, four of them. And now we're back. We need to tell the other side of the story, this, the Utah civilian side. These surely some civilians interacted with these prisoners who are still living. They would all be very young, like my grandmother, of course. And we found 100 that lived in Ogden who had responded to newspaper articles and things that we put out.
100?
And wow. Yeah, 100. And Allie Lee Lawler was one individual that I met, not through the newspaper, but she was one of the few who was still talking about it. And in fact, her husband, who we interviewed and ultimately didn't use in the film, I wish we had. If we had gotten to him just a little earlier in life, we would have used it. But they had met while working at the Ogden Depot. Hmm. He was a guard of the German prisoners, and she worked in the Defense Depot and worked with some of these prisoners and, of course, went to visit her husband, and who was guarding all these Germans, and they became great friends with a lot of these prisoners. So she has a lot of experience that she's drawing upon as she talks. But it didn't always start out in the most friendly way. I mean, these women especially were taught that it was treason to talk or share anything with the German prisoners. But even that, of course, broke down over time.
Here's another moment from the film.
The prisoners of war were the closest that most Americans, certainly most Utahns, came to the actual enemy. And it's wartime. This is a life or death situation. It's not a time to embrace people and remember good Christian teachings of loving your enemy and taking care of them.
In my particular job, the whole warehouse was full of German prisoners of war, but I was never allowed to talk to them privately as a person. It was considered treason. I was terrified of them because of the war movies and things that I'd seen. You know, they were really, as far as I was concerned, guilty of a lot of atrocities, and I was really, really scared of them. I used to sing a lot. I studied music, and I was singing in German in my office one day, not even thinking about those prisoners. I went to lunch, and when I got back, I had a note on my typewriter. My knees shook, my arms shook, I shook all over. I was scared to death. And it said, "Would you teach me about this country and God? If you want to meet me at Bay 5 or something on Pallet 6. And I was sure I didn't go that way. anywhere near that way.
But of course she warms up to them, and I think everyone eventually does, stops seeing them as these sort of terrifying creatures and started seeing them as human beings.
Well, when they stop and show you a picture,
yeah,
says 1,000 words to you of children back at home, you realize that these are human beings. Certainly not all of them were good human beings. You know, they've made some horrible choices, some of them, but some of them were just in there like we were, you know, and they just got mixed up in it. And so I think she learned that a lot of them were that way.
The idea of working side by side, like work is a theme almost in the film.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this happened all over the state, and not just the state of Utah, but all over the country. These Germans worked in factories on lines, you know, working tomato canning. They would be there to empty the slop buckets, and they would interact with the Americans doing simple tasks like that.
Great photos in that section, by the way.
Say that
there's some great photos in that section.
Yeah, and that was another challenge.
Yeah,
finding photos.
That.
We found lots of stories, but boy, artifacts are sure hard. But boy, their interaction was just interesting. And there were some bad interaction too. We should be clear. There's not always positive interaction. Some of it was negative. But the majority of it, truthfully, as we've researched, was positive, which I find very interesting. I would have thought at my age, 33, I would have thought most of it would have been negative.
Yeah.
Enemies interacting. How could it not be? They're enemies. But the majority of it was positive. And I find that to be very, very interesting. But beyond the working in factories, the thing that really fascinates me was the working in fields, because I think that's when you get even more meaningful interaction. Now you have one guard out there who's asleep under the truck anyways, because he knows these prisoners aren't going anywhere. And the prisoners are out there with a civilian family, with civilian neighbors working in these fields. And they talk just like my grandmother talked. And she was a young girl. Allie, as we just mentioned, she was quite a bit older at the time. But they talked.
Yeah.
And even though they didn't speak German, they talked. They would do hand signals. They would, you know, they still talked. There's interesting stories about some of them playing games together, playing marbles, and you just learn a little bit about each other from those types of experiences.
Here's another moment from the film. We'll meet Gene Taylor here, and we'll also hear from Andrew Kramer, the professor.
He just took a liking to me. He's the enemy. And normally you'd be wanting to shoot him, kill him. You know, he's the enemy. And every day he'd talk to me, and he tried to teach me to speak German. To this day, I speak German. Ein, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, sechs, sieben, acht, neun, zehn. So they could have been the neighbors next door instead of German prisoners of war. They were just that nice of people.
I don't think anybody else had that close contact, but Farr families did. Farr families often brought them into the house to have lunch. The German prisoners often made little handicrafts, which they gave to the Farr family. They got along quite well.
Let's talk about this incident in Salina. There was a camp there, not a large one, I don't think, right? How many soldiers?
250. It's called a branch camp. So it was set up just for agriculture, just so that they could help the local people get their crops in before they were destroyed.
So this story, when did you hear about this in the scheme of things? I mean, you'd heard about the fact that there were German POWs. When did you hear about the fact that one American soldier went nuts and started shooting at German soldiers?
Soon after, yeah. I had heard my grandmother's story. It's documented very well in Alan Kent Powell's book. But if you were to Google the subject, and this is one of the first things you'll find, and it makes sense that you would, because it is such a defining kind of moment for Utah with this German prisoner of war experience, that it's around more than any other story. But in some ways, it's as hidden and lost as any other story, and something, again, that we don't hear about in our history books, but is very, very fascinating, yeah, I think, for Utahns to study.
This is in July of 1945. As you said before, the war was essentially over. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was still the campaign going on in the Pacific, but for the most part, the European part of it, the Germans had surrendered. And a soldier seems like a pretty troubled guy.
Absolutely.
Bad soldier, mm-hmm, had been court-martialed before, and essentially he had been sent to Salina to sort of get him out of the way.
Yeah. You can't cause any problems in,
right,
Salina.
Yep. Clarence Bertucci is his name. Tell the story. What happens?
So it's the evening of July 8th, 1945, and his shift, he was a guard at the local camp there, and if you've been to Salina, this is on the west side of, the east side of town. Basically, you head east and you're there.
Yeah.
And in this camp, there was 250 prisoners asleep because his shift started at midnight. So it's dark. Before going to the camp to start his shift, he went down to the Mom's Cafe there on Main Street and talked to the waitresses for a moment and said something a little eerie to them about, you know, doing something that was going to, you know, he was going to do something that night.
Yeah.
Then he walks up to the camp and climbs the tower about midnight, goes straight to a newly installed machine gun. Again, this is after the war, and they just installed a machine gun to, I guess, protect, you know, and keep the Germans, keep the Americans safe. He for whatever reason, loads it and just starts shooting. So you can imagine you're in the city of Salina. It's midnight. You're most of the city and civilians are sleeping, and then they hear gunfire. So what do you think they think of? They think the Germans are escaping, of course.
Right, of course.
Maybe
because it's
an hour.
Town already traumatized,
oh,
by war. Of
sure,
course.
Sure. Maybe a half an hour later, they now hear a new thing. They hear screams. They hear yells of people who are down many blocks from this camp at a hospital, and this hospital had 16 rooms. There was a woman giving birth. Most of the rooms were filled, and now here comes scores of I shouldn't say scores. There was more than 20 wounded prisoners coming in. You know, in the back of pickup trucks and being dropped off, and nobody to care for him. One nurse on duty who wasn't even really a nurse. There was a doctor in the town who came, and townspeople were the people who came.
But that's the point. I mean, that entire town was enlisted to to deal with that? I mean, like Salina gathered even the young kids.
That's right. So we interviewed a boy at the time. He was 13 years old. And we interviewed a couple of 13-year-olds, I should say, but one of them, his only memory of this was the sound, the popping sound, as he described it. And then, of course, walking down the street to the hospital and his dad and him picking up these bodies and carrying them in and out of the hospital, some of whom were dead, some were screaming and in agony. Another boy that we interviewed, who's now much older, but was a boy at the time, was 600 feet from the camp. So this is now on the other side of town, and heard the sound, of course, and then walks outside his front door and sees in front of his grandmother's house, which was right next to his house, these prisoners being laid there. And his description of them is pretty remarkable.
We lived 600 feet from a prison camp. Scared us so bad we didn't know what in the heck had happened, that machine gun going off. The men packed them down and laid them on the grass lawn in front of my grandmother's house. We walked up there, and boy, they told us now, go home, now. They had blankets laying on them, and we didn't know what it was. It just, to be truthful with you, it looked like a whole bunch of sheep laying there on the lawn, covered up.
I want to ask you about, we were referring to this a little bit earlier, when the revelations and the images start to come about what the Nazis had been doing to Jews and others in these concentration camps, the sort of brutality of it, the war atrocities. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you mentioned in the film is that the German POWs were required to watch these films.
Mm-hmm.
How are they reacting to what they were seeing?
I think this is a really, again, another fascinating example from history that we don't understand as Americans and Utahns. So again, imagine you are a German prisoner. And as we talked earlier, it's a mixed bag whether you know or understand anything about what your government is doing to the Jews. And then the Americans, the Allies, uncover it. And they're broadcasting it everywhere, including in these German prisoner of war camps. And the way that they did that is they would take the same films that they were showing to Germans, you know, the citizens in Germany, and to the Americans, and they forced every prisoner. They had sign-up sheets. They had to actually sign their name that they had viewed this film.
Wow.
And they put films in every camp across the country, or at least in all of the main camps. All the prisoners were required to see them. And their reactions, this is one of the few times where we actually have examples of their reactions. There's photographs, some of which have garnered some attention in the media nationally, even in the last few years, of prisoners covering their faces, some of them crying, others looking, staring blankly as if they don't believe, or perhaps just in shock. But I think their reaction as you look at these photos is telling of this mixed bag of what they really understood. And again, we interview some of the prisoners in the film who describe it as, this is Hollywood at its finest.
This can't be real.
We
wouldn't do something like this.
This is what Hollywood does.
Yeah.
They make up propaganda, you know, I mean, during the war. I mean, this is a propaganda film. But by the end of the war, well, the war was over at this time. By the end of their incarceration, it was hard for any of them not to believe it. As we've researched it, most, they came to know it was real.
And some had a sense that, of course, this is real.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some knew right off.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. But I think the mood in the camp certainly changed. And in what ways, I don't know that we'll ever know exactly, but we get quotes like that Splinters of a Nation quote we talked about, where the title of the film comes from.
And a really beautiful quote from Joachim Artel.
Mm-hmm.
I won't play. I will leave it for people to hear. One of the things he mentions is how the images that he saw had left deep marks in our hearts, mm-hmm, as soldiers that this had happened. And this idea comes forward where he says that we need to try to then now go forward and try to prove ourselves worthy to, mm-hmm, be part of society again.
Mm-hmm.
That was a struggle. And I'm sure they imagined that, that they, in order to sort of get themselves back into normalcy again, I guess they knew what they were up, were in for, I suppose.
Yeah, but you can imagine trying to go home and rebuild. I mean, most of these prisoners went home to families who were, some of them living, some of them not living. One of the guys we interviewed, his twin brother had been killed. He didn't learn for several years. Another one, his family lived in a cave. Another one walked miles and miles and miles with his family. All that they had literally were some birds that they owned. That was the only thing they owned. And then you look, as I did, I was there 70 years later, at the lives these people have built. And that was, for me, that was one of my most interesting questions. I always wanted to know. I wanted to ask a German prisoner, what did you learn? I mean, how did you rebuild? You guys were hated, you know, and now today you look at Germany, you'd never know, especially as someone at my age. Young people today don't realize what Germany was and what it's turned into, what it's become. But for me, it's very interesting. And the same thing can be said of the Japanese. I think our relationship with Japan, it's very interesting. I mean, these we were hated enemies, you know, and now we're great allies.
Scott Porter, his new documentary is called Splinters of a Nation. You can see it next Wednesday night. We're screening it as part of our Through the Lens series. It's our collaboration with the Utah Film Center. Scott's going to be there along with the historian Alan Kent Powell. They'll join us for the Q&A after the film. We should also mention Splinters of a Nation is going to be airing later this month on KUED Channel 7, October 24th. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Scott, thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
We'll see you next week.
Yep.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.